Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
To do. We got the Cardinals game later tonight on KMOX, and whoo, boy, it's going to be an exciting one. So 7:08 first pitch. I know my son's going to want to stay up late and watch it, but I'm not going to be able to turn it on until after he goes to bed. I know. I don't want to give him that temptation. I can't have him staying up that late. This ain't the World Series. Now let's wait and make the series. By all means, the kid's staying up late with me. On any of those late night games where we just so happen to be off. So, hey, let me open the phone lines for you. You're invited to call. Anything you want to talk about this last hour, you have that option to bellyache, or you have that option to praise, or just for whatever public service you want. 314-436-7900 or 800-925-1120. You know, I saw this story. Yellow-haired Muppet Carly helps Sesame Street tackle addiction. You know what I learned today? So I read this article, and Sesame Street put a press release out, but I'm getting this from NBC News. One of their characters, Carly, in May, was introduced as a foster child.
Hi, Elmo. I'm so glad you could join us for Pizza Party Tuesday.
Yeah, Elmo, too. Boy, Elmo loves pizza parties, especially when they're with Elmo's friend, Carly.
Oh, I'm so happy you could come. Spot over here.
Yeah.
Because
so they do the pizza party and like, oh, she gets bummed out and she leaves and Elmo's got some questions.
I don't really want to tell you about it.
She's having a hard time, Elmo. But we're here for her. We're her for now parents. Hey, Carly. Hey, we know some things are hard to talk about, but we're listening. Why don't we go over there and have a chat for a second?
Yeah, so it goes through, and originally she was introduced in May as a foster child, okay? She was being brought in while her parents were going through some hard times. Sesame Street and some of these other PBS programs have found ways to address and tackle some pretty difficult things for kids. So when I saw this one, how do you handle a parent with addiction? And I thought, whoa, that's a little much for a kid, right? Well, I found out later that this is part of the Sesame Street workshop. And what they do is they post these videos online as resources if you want to use this, if you need this sort of thing, which I thought, this is perfect. This is good. A lot of times, inside certain homes, it's hard to find something that's relatable when you're going through a difficult time. And the kid, through no fault of his own, it's not the kid's fault that they're in this foster program. It's not the kid's fault that the parents are addicted and have some kind of other issues or whatever it may be going on. But if you need some help coping with that or understanding that and you're a young child, they put these resources out there that try to explain it to kids. And you know what? I think they handle it responsibly. In fact, this is the video that was posted on how they handle parental addiction. You know what I learned for the first time? Elmo has a dad. Did you know Elmo had a dad? So it shows them they're on a park bench. And Elmo's there with his dad. His dad's wearing like the Adidas jumpsuit that you would see on The Sopranos. You know, he's wearing like the Adidas jumpsuit and sitting next to Elmo and trying to explain to his son what parental addiction's about.
Elmo knows that Carly's mommy was away for a while, but now she's back. But Carly's mommy looks and acts different than she did before.
Yeah, Carly's mommy seems much healthier since she's been back.
Hmm. How come Carly's mommy had to go away?
Well, son, Carly's mommy has a kind of sickness, and she had to get some help.
Sickness? Mm-hmm. Oh, like when Elmo has the sniffles?
Oh, no, it's not that kind of sickness. Carly's mommy has a disease called addiction. Addiction makes people feel like they need a grown-up drink called alcohol or another kind of drug to feel okay. That can make a person act strange in ways they can't control.
But why doesn't she just stop?
It's not something you can just stop doing, not without help from the right grown-ups.
Yeah, so they're sitting on this park bench and they're having this conversation, and there's a whole series of pretty serious issues that kids may be dealing with because of their parents' addiction or whatnot. You know, when they say alcohol or drugs or whatever it is, I mean, there's some pretty serious things that kids are, like, even look here in St. Louis, these kids see their parents have drug addictions. All across the United States, there's opioid addictions that parents are getting onto. How many? It seems like every day, it's almost a normal occurrence in America somewhere. There's a kid that's strapped into a car seat in the back while the parents are passed out in the front. It's sad. It's really sad. And just like Mr. Rogers in the past, he realized a few different things. Mr. Rogers, when he would approach his television show, would realize that sometimes these kids only had this television in front of them. Their parents were not necessarily involved with their life. They weren't hands-on with their life. They didn't give them attention like other parents may have. And Mr. Rogers said, okay, we're going to cover some tough things, but we're going to do it in order to try to help the kids understand that there is someone out there that cares for them, even if it is this character on a television show, because it would be a shame if kids grew up feeling like no one cared about them, you know? So Sesame Street's doing something. They post these videos online. It sounds like they don't actually broadcast this as part of regular Sesame Street. So the ABCs and the 1-2-3s and the songs and the whatever it is, they still do the same thing for Sesame Street, but they introduce this character as a way to try to bring some of the pretty serious conditions that some kids are in. In case you need this as a resource. I think it's great that they do it. I think it's really smart that they do it. Here's the number, 436-7900 or 800-925-1120. You can look that up if you did a search for, it's just the Sesame Street Workshop online. They post those videos. You know, you can't search YouTube for them. You have to go through the Sesame Street Workshop to get to it. Like, you can go to YouTube and try to search that where the video is hosted. It doesn't come up in the search. It's set as private. You have to be directed to it from the Sesame Street Workshop. So even then, you're not accidentally going to stumble upon those videos. Let me get to Eric real quick, who's calling in from Indiana. What's going on, Eric?
Hello, my friend. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk to you about concerns that I have. I'm legally blind, and I am married. My wife and I wanted to come to the ballpark, but we're very concerned about both of them, the things you touched on, thankfully, last hour, and like using the Metrolink and actually staying in certain areas of town. We don't know what's good.
Oh, yeah.
What are good areas to stay, and all this killing, and it's just, we've stayed away. We used to like the city, but we stayed away.
Huh. So are you trying to plan a visit in the future, or are you saying that you're not going to?
Well, no, I'm not passing judgment where and never, but other than to say that we've heard of all these concerns, and we're afraid to come into the city.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know what your views were, and if you would be, you know, I'm not asking you to endorse a hotel. Don't get me wrong. I understand you can't do that. Mm-hmm. But I would love to hear from somebody who could say, hey, this is a good area to stay. Stay here.
Hmm.
You see my point?
Yeah, this is what I've seen. So there's a few things that I've been able to understand. So day games usually are not an issue, except there are sometimes people going through breaking into cars. But we just had a report at KMOX.com. They're adding extra police to make sure that's not going to happen. We had this string like last year and 2 years ago were terrible. People going through. There was a string of like 3 or 4 people just busting into cars. And they had so much evidence that it took them forever just to process all of it. They had a whole storage room filled with the stuff that these group of people stole. So I think that's starting to quiet down. But if you look at the crime statistics, it seems it's about the same. That's probably your biggest concern. If you're with a large group of people It seems like that's the best time to ride public transportation during like a Cardinals game if someone's coming in. But I'll tell you personally, Eric, I would never step foot on the Metrolink. Not a chance. Take an Uber, that you're going to have a much safer time, or drive yourself and pay the $30 it costs to park downtown during a game. But I'm not risking it. And, you know, people go online, they get upset when you say bad things about Metrolink, but there's some very serious security concerns they haven't addressed. Your only saving grace in that one is that you're going to find a bunch of Cardinals fans and Cardinals jerseys. And normally you don't see those terrible things at that point. But man, I'm not doing it. Sorry. There's nothing you can do to convince me to do it.
Let me ask you this, if I may. Is the Redbird Express safe?
That's still Metrolink, right?
I've heard it's a bus.
Oh, that's
system,
the
sir.
Bus. That's probably safer. Yeah, that's probably much safer. Well, is that through Metrolink, the Redbird Express?
Well, see, I don't know. That's one reason I want to talk to you, was because I understand it does go over to Illinois. You board the bus, it's like $10, and it takes you. They pick you up in front of the ballpark. Mm-hmm.
You don't hear too much about that, actually, and when it comes to crime issues. Honestly, maybe it's just underreported, but you don't hear a lot. I think the more specialty ones like that are different. Yeah, I couldn't answer that definitively, but yeah, I guess you can give that a try. A lot of time, go to a day game. You're going to find a much better chance. A weekend day game like there is on Saturday was like a perfect opportunity, but you're going to have a lot of those next season, too.
Really? You think that's pretty good?
I don't know. I don't have any experience or heard any stories of them. Yeah. Maybe some people listening right now has tried the Redbird Express. Give us a call. Let us know. Give us an honest opinion. Okay. Keep listening, Eric. Maybe we'll get a couple calls.
Thank you, my friend.
All right. Thanks. Bye. All right. So 436-7900 or 800-925-1120. Share your experience. Call in. Let me know. Does Eric have the right to be concerned? It's Overnight America, KMOX. All right, right before the break, Eric called in and he was hoping that you can give some of your experiences using public transportation. Metrolink, for example, during a Cardinals game. You see, Eric being out of town, lives in Indiana. At least I think he lives in Indiana, but he said he's blind and his wife would be traveling with him, but still, it's probably easier for them to take alternate ways to the ballpark. Mark, calling from St. Louis, what's your experience?
Hey, Ryan, I was just telling the producer, I talked to you before about this situation. Mm-hmm. I am a bus driver, and normally during like ball games, especially day games, they usually have heightened security with St. Louis County and St. Louis City on the Metrolink. So mm-hmm. The Metrolink is pretty safe during some of the day hours, especially during, something like this playoff series.
Right. I saw Elliot Davis do some pieces on this. So after a game, he went down onto some of the different platforms where he would live stream this and show that there were no security after a game. Do they actually secure them after, or is it just before a game?
Well, they normally secure them during the games. Right before the game and during the games. But, in the latter part of the innings, like when it gets around the seventh inning and people start leaving, you have security is not as present as it would be during the games. Mm-hmm. And it's something else I like to advise, too. With this Missouri Open carry gun thing, you have a lot of people that are carrying weapons now, and you talked about a lot of the stuff that was the police had that mm-hmm. people had to claim. I recommend the gun carriers not carry any weapons because they can't take them inside, and a lot of the thieves know this. So people that do carry their firearms, they normally leave them in the car, and that's how a lot of them get stolen because when these thieves break into the cars, that's normally what they're looking for is weapons because they know they can't take them into the hockey games, they can't take them into the the baseball games, so they either leave them in the car or leave them in the trunk. So I would advise anybody that carries a weapon not to take it with them at all.
It's a very good tip. Thank you for that, Mark. Good to hear from you.
All right, thank you.
All right, so Mark says heightened security. It seems when you're traveling with a lot of other Cardinals fans that are using the same thing, that things are a little bit better than, let's say, you're any other day you may be traveling, in the afternoon in particular. Eric in St. Louis, hi.
Hey, how are you? I'm going to turn my radio down, if you don't mind.
Go ahead, please. There it is. I still hear it.
Yeah, this is me. Hey, right, I want to apologize for being rude to you in the past. Mm-hmm. I'm getting this radio turned down. But what I'm saying is they had things or lockers where you could put basically get the guns out of the cars because that's where they're all stolen. And you could put them in there and then go to the game and come out. And it, personally, I like the clear bag policy, and I'll let you go. Excuse me for taking over your radio show. But I think I'm a St. Louis resident, and there's no way in hell, no way in heck, I'm going downtown without carrying.
Mm. Eric, I wonder about those storage lockers. Where are they located?
They were legalized by the Democrats in St. Louis City. The guy was a Army veteran, and what he was going to do is he was going to basically pull in a trailer, and you put your card in, and he does a background check on you, mm-hmm. and then you store your weapon before you go to the game, and you get it when you leave.
Interesting. All right, Eric.
That's why you don't put a Colt 45 or anything on the back of your car, because all the people are trying to steal your weapons.
They look for that.
We're just trying to defend ourselves.
Yeah, I get it. All right, thanks, Eric.
Thank you so much. Right, I love you. Take care.
Oh, that's nice. Marjorie calling in from Illinois. Yeah. Hi.
Oh, hi, Ryan. I live in Illinois, but shall I ask about the Redbird Express?
Yeah.
I have taken that before, but it was from Belleville, over at the shopping center in Belleville. Uh-huh. And it was a nice, fast ride downtown. Boy, those drivers sure knew how to go.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then they leave you out about a block, maybe a block and a half from the stadium, and then you have to walk to it, and then they pick you up to go back that way.
Oh, really? Do you know where they drop you off at?
It's about a block and a half.
Yeah.
I don't know. What is that? Down at the stadium's on, 6th or 7th Street, and then maybe the next one over?
Yeah, I'm trying to look online to see if I can find a map.
Kind of in front of, isn't there a hotel down there?
Like the Hilton?
The Hilton or something.
Yeah, so you're really close, so it's like right across. Yeah.
It's really close from there, and then they pick you up from there, and so you don't have too far to ride, walk to get to the stadium. It's really closer than even parking in the garage.
Yeah.
And where you do is you wind up parking at the shopping center.
Oh, I see. So I'm looking online right now. So it's $5 to ride if you're an adult.
Uh huh.
Not bad.
I think that's right.
Yeah. I guess it sounds pretty popular. I haven't heard anything good or bad about it. I just know it exists.
No. Well, I know it's they're really, they really give you a fast ride down there. I mean, they don't fool around.
Oh, it's expensive. Day games, when I see, luckily, our radio stations are downtown, so I have a parking garage here at the station. It's a long walk. It's like a 15-minute walk from here, 10 to 15 minutes when you get stopped for red lights and things like that. But, it's okay for me. It doesn't bother me doing something like that. But you walk by the parking garage, it's $30 to park right by the stadium, So I see why this is appealing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. It's much better economically. I think the problem with St. Louis and the crime is that they don't prosecute people. They're letting them go too easy. That prosecutor down there, mm-hmm. she just lets them go. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. All right, Marjorie, thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
All right,
bye-bye.
All right. We'll take a look at your weather coming up on Overnight America, KMOX. Joining us now, a former special assistant to FBI Director James Comey. Josh Campbell has a new book out called Crossfire Hurricane, Inside Donald Trump's War on the FBI. Thanks for coming on to KMOX.
Thanks so much for having me. A real pleasure.
So I kind of want to first start with your role in the FBI. What kind of things were you doing?
So I had a pretty long career doing a number of different assignments. I'd started at headquarters. Then once I became an FBI agent, I went out to the field. did a number of assignments in the counterterrorism realm, you know, domestically, and then had the opportunity to be part of one of the FBI's small teams that is actually responsible for international missions, and that is conducting terrorism investigations overseas, kidnapping investigations overseas, spent a lot of time lashed up with counterparts from CIA and the Defense Department and the various international spaces. And then as I progressed in my career, went back to headquarters, and one of my last assignments was serving as special assistant to then FBI Director James Comey.
Yeah. Were you there working under James Comey at the very start of the Russian investigation?
I was. I was there at headquarters and seemingly through two very tumultuous investigations. So there was the Hillary Clinton case, which I was there for, but then also, which would come, you know, after that, obviously, is the investigation into members of the Trump campaign and their ties to Russia. And that's what I write about in the book, is really bringing, you know, your listeners inside that experience, what it was like to work in this agency that was now investigating, you know, essentially both candidates for high office. Mm-hmm. You had the Democrats and then obviously people associated with Trump and then later Trump himself under investigation based on his the actions that he took as it related to Comey. And then I take readers through the firing of Jim Comey. I was there that day when he received word that he was no longer the director of the FBI, which really threw this agency into a state of chaos. Because at the time, you know, the reason that was given to the public was because James Comey was too mean to Hillary Clinton. But in reality, those of us who knew, you know, what was going on as it related to Russia knew that it was probably more sinister than that. And the president would later admit that it was Russia on his mind when he decided to get rid of the FBI director.
You say as part of this book, the Russian investigation code name was Crossfire Hurricane, which is the name of your book, Inside Donald Trump's War on the FBI. And was there a code name for Hillary Clinton's emails?
There was. The code name for that case was Mid-Year Exam. And people try to read into what, you know, these code names actually mean. It's not as exciting, I think, as most people probably think. It's essentially, you know, when you have a high-profile investigation that's being very tightly held to just a small group for purposes of operational security, it will be assigned a code name, unlike other FBI investigations, which are essentially just named based on who the suspect is in the case. So for Hillary, it was Mid-Year Exam. And again, for the Russia investigation, pulling from, I think, an old Rolling Stones song, they went with Crossfire Hurricane.
Oh, I never knew that one. What's is that the title of the song? Might have to look that one up.
It was the title of one of their songs, yeah. You know, it's so interesting, and I read about the book. It's actually a good metaphor for where the FBI found itself, you know. I mean, squarely between, you know, two entities that were blasting it, you know, down the street from Congress and then the White House, really in this chaotic storm as it attempted to weather, you know, these investigations, and, you know, very much found, at least the people inside the FBI found themselves in a position that they had never been in, and that was fair game for political attacks. And, you know, as I write about, as the president attempted to essentially deflect, you know, from the Russia investigation, his goal was to try to bring down or bring to heel the investigators who are running the case.
Wow. I think that would be a fun job to have in the FBI, someone that gets to name some of these code names. Former Special Assistant to the FBI Director James Comey is joining us here. His name is Josh Campbell, and his book Crossfire Hurricane is out now. I'm wondering, at the very onset of that Crossfire Hurricane, when you started, what was the scope of the investigation at that point?
So the investigation initially started because a Trump campaign aide named George Papadopoulos, who has now you know, become a very public figure and a bit of a conspiracy theorist, a bit is being generous. He's a very much a conspiracy theorist in my book. Essentially, he was in London at a bar speaking with an Australian diplomat and let loose that he knew that the Russians had dirt on candidate Hillary Clinton. And at the time, the ambassador to Australia, who he was talking with there in London, didn't really know what to make of it. It didn't really mean anything to him. But afterwards, as we all now know, the Russians were engaged in this brazen attempt to hack into the Democratic National Committee, to steal information, to weaponize information in order to thwart public opinion. After that started coming to light, this diplomat, you know, put two and two together and wondered if the dirt that Papadopoulos was bragging about may have been alluding to this campaign of attack against the DNC. And so he did what any good diplomat would do, or his country did, and picked up the phone to the FBI. And it was at that point that the FBI was staring at a really troubling set of facts, because it wasn't just Papadopoulos with these suspicious ties to the Russians. But there were three other Trump campaign people, for a total of four, Paul Manafort, Michael Flynn, and Carter Page, who all had their own sinister ties to the Russians. And so, you know, staring at those facts, the FBI did what it does. You know, if there's a potential threat to national security, it opens an investigation. And, you know, Crossfire Hurricane was born out of that.
When was the actual start of that investigation? Do you remember when that happened?
And this has actually been still up for great debate, regardless of, you know, how many times people that, like me, that were in government and, you know, other experts say. The case began in July 2016, again, following this meeting with Papadopoulos. But what the president and you know, some of his enablers continue to still peddle is the idea that this investigation stemmed from the so-called Steele dossier. This was the British spy who was employed by a Democratic-linked firm to gather opposition research on Donald Trump. This was the substance of that infamous Trump Tower meeting where Comey is briefing Trump on the salacious material that this spy had found. But regardless of, you know, that, I know that's just spin, because the actual genesis of the investigation, as Robert Mueller indicated in his report, started in July of 2016 from that one meeting, again, where you had a Trump campaign official who was boasting about knowing what the Russians were up to as it related to going after Hillary Clinton.
Did you work in the FBI until the conclusion of the Mueller report, or were you gone before that?
No, so I left in February of 2018, and by that time, the investigation was still very much, you know, underway at that point. And, you know, it's fascinating as I look back on the career, because, you know, as I write about in the book, the FBI is an agency that I love, that I still love to this day. It was a mission unlike any other. But I came to the realization, and, you know, I was sitting there with my colleagues inside the FBI on the receiving end of this campaign of attack by the president of the United States, who was day in and day out calling us crooks, calling us criminals, you know, the so-called deep state, these people who are out to get him, which he was essentially saying that we violated our oath to the Constitution. And, you know, that started as frustration and soon built into up to anger. And I looked around and there weren't leaders inside the Justice Department who were willing to stand up to the president and say that what he was saying was not only wrong, but would have long-term consequences on public safety. I mean, the attorney general was silent. The deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, was silent. And so I just looked in. You know, I thought, okay, if I don't speak up now, I'm going to regret this years later down, you know, when I retire, if knowing I just kept my head down to draw a paycheck. So I decided to step out at that point and just help the American people really understand what is fact, what is fiction. These agencies are imperfect. I write about a lot of their faults in the book. They have to be held to account when they make mistakes. But it is nothing like the agency that the president would have you believe the FBI is, you know, this deep state, you know, organization filled with criminals. In fact, it's an organization of patriots that work again every day to protect this country.
Josh Campbell is author of Crossfire Hurricane, joining us now on KMOX. And I'm wondering, after the report came out, the Mueller report, if there were any conclusions or anything that was in that report that may have been contradictory to some of the things that you worked on while you were involved in the investigation.
No, not contradictory. In fact, I mean, it was revelatory in the sense that, you know, Mueller had an all-star team of investigators that were hard charging on this investigation. And one thing that may fascinate your listeners is I still talk with, you know, folks that are inside the FBI, and there's this general consensus that had Donald Trump not fired James Comey, obviously we wouldn't have a Robert Mueller on the scene. And although the FBI was investigating members of the Trump campaign, I think because there was this really aggressive effort to bring this large team together, I mean, they started finding out all kinds of criminality, you know, regarding people in Trump world and issuing indictment after indictment. And I just wonder how life may have turned out for a lot of these people, again, had Donald Trump not made the decision to fire the person who was leading the investigation into his campaign.
Mm. I think some of the things that became pretty well known during the course of the investigation had to do with Lisa Page and Peter Strzok. Did you work with them?
I did, and I write about them in the book. I mean, you know, as someone who's now in journalism, you know, my first priority is obviously to ensuring that our viewers and listeners and readers, that they're told the truth and they have an accurate depiction of what's reality. And that being the case, although I thought highly of both of them, you know, inside the FBI, you stare at their actions and what they did, and as I write about in Crossfire Hurricane, they brought great shame to the FBI through their lack of judgment, you know, on a number of fronts. And, you know, they've since been held accountable. Neither of them are still at the FBI. Now, I do think Strzok's case has been politicized beyond anything that should have happened to a public servant. I mean, to have the president of the United States, you know, personally blasting him on Twitter, to have the, you know, this group of enablers in Congress really destroying the reputation of this person, using him as a villain, I think is disgusting. But that said, you know, if I take the names away from both of these people and look at their actions, I do fault them for what they did. And as I mentioned, they've since been held accountable.
You know, if just from behind the scenes sense, when those text messages became available and the media started to report and show the screenshots and some of the different text that were inside of those text messages, was that awkward? I mean, for someone that when you know someone personally and you work with them and they're a colleague and something like that becomes national news, how did that change the working relationship?
Yeah, you know, I'd say more than awkward. I mean, it was infuriating. Again, because you had people who just exercised such terrible judgment. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that what the president is trying to portray, that these two were, you know, tipping the scale and trying to arrange an investigation to bring him down, that is just garbage. That's nonsense. Because if they really, if that was their goal, to bring down Donald Trump, they would have stopped him before he ever got elected. They would have leaked the fact that his campaign was under investigation. But obviously they didn't do that because these were public servants who knew that they had to do their work in secret, again, you know, in the counterintelligence space. So, you know, it was infuriating for us who, you know, anyone inside the FBI to look at what happened and know that someone made such bad decisions. But again, you know, the goal of these two, I think they were venting, and obviously they had deep animus toward Donald Trump. But the FBI is such, and I really take readers inside the dynamic inside my book about how this agency works. There's no way that one or two people or a group of people would be able to manufacture an investigation to bring down anyone, because there's so many checks and balances that go beyond the FBI that would have stopped that from happening. But nevertheless, you know, the president continues that campaign trying to portray himself as a victim.
Author Josh Campbell, a former FBI agent and special assistant to James Comey. His new book's called Crossfire Hurricane, Inside Donald Trump's War on the FBI. We'll continue our conversation with him next on Overnight America, KMOX. Josh Campbell joins us, author of Crossfire Hurricane, Inside Donald Trump's War on the FBI. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I just wanted to ask you about Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. And something that was brought up was how they may have handled the investigation into Hillary Clinton, which was investigation mid-year exam. I just wanted to say that again. These code names for the FBI are pretty cool. So, and then there was also a question of, did they handle those separate instances differently? So his role with mid-year exam versus his role with Crossfire Hurricane, one looking into Hillary Clinton, one looking into Donald Trump. A lot of what was reported on was that they may have shown some favoritism in the way that they handled the two separate cases, being one showing favoritism towards Hillary Clinton and one showing some sort of disdain towards Donald Trump. Did you notice any of that? Or maybe after the fact, when some people started reporting this, was there even a look at if that happened?
No, well, there was a look by an outside entity, the Department of Justice Inspector General, who did a thorough, exhaustive review of the handling of the Clinton case. And by the way, they're actually working on an investigation into the origins of the Russia case, as you and I speak right now. But that independent review found that obviously these two had, again, deep animus towards Trump. They allowed that to, you know, be on full display within their communications, their political biases. But the independent review found that there were no investigative steps that were impacted by their political beliefs. And I think that's important to understand. I mean, obviously, I'm not giving them a pass because those actions, again, are really disgraceful. But again, to understand how the FBI works, I mean, you have the FBI recruits people who are, you know, top notch, a certain caliber, that are curious about the world. And, you know, you don't have form a curiosity about the world without also forming an opinion about what you learn. So, you know, as they looked at Donald Trump's actions, especially in attacking this Gold Star family and the like, you know, they obviously responded to that, they thought, you know, talking to each other in a very vicious way. But again, the FBI is an organization that, you know, let's say the president was right, that they were trying to concoct an investigation to bring him down. All of the results of their case would have to be laid out in a court of law. And, you know, so if you play it forward, I mean, you see the house of cards that this argument is. So there's no way that that would have an impact investigation, even if they wanted to. And I think that that's a good thing to have these checks and balances. And by the way, to have the inspector general looking over your shoulder. Again, these agencies have such great power, and with that power comes oversight. And, you know, I'm confident that these independent agencies, the inspector general specifically, is able to do an exhaustive review and really try to help, you know, public discern what's fact and what's fiction.
Josh, if people wanted to check out your book, Crossfire Hurricane, where can they find it?
So it is available now in all major booksellers around the country and independent bookstores. It's also available on Amazon. This is my first book. I've been really humbled by the reception that it's received thus far. It was a Amazon new release bestseller. So I want to thank everybody for your support. But that's how you get the book. And again, you know, what I hope the reader understands is that this is not just the view of one person who lived through all of this. I went out and I interviewed dozens of people in and outside of government to get a full, you know, view and spectrum about what transpired in this major high profile, you know, period of time for the FBI. And I, again, go through, you know, no one gets a pass. You know, even my former boss, FBI Director James Comey, who I think very, very highly of, there are mistakes that he made that I point out as well. So, again, my goal is to help your listener, help the reader, especially in this time where we are being lied to every single day, it seems, by people in power, to try to help bring some semblance of truth, again, to how these agencies operate, what their mission is, and just as important, how that mission is negatively impacted when politicians put these agencies in their crosshairs.
All right. He joins us on the Quiver River Electric Camoex guest line. Thank you to Josh Campbell, the former FBI agent. That does it for us here on Overnight America. We'll be back again Sunday night. Go Cardinals. Let's hope they get the first two here home at Busch Stadium. We'll see you again Sunday night. Good night.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.